It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, beautiful listeners. It's your host, Tembi Lopp. Welcome to Lifted, a podcast that pulls back the curtain on creativity, resilience, and the extraordinary moments when everything changes. My guest is Amelia Ramp, a Filipino-American food and travel writer, recipe developer, video host, and food stylist based in Brooklyn, New York. Her work has been published by Bon Appetit, Food52, and TheKitchen.com. And she is currently a senior food editor at Food & Wine. Amelia's recipes blend practical information, cultural context, and her own personal history to create a holistic guide to each recipe. And she has written eloquently about the dying art of food writing. There are so many insightful surprises in our conversation, and I learned a lot, including why she's interested in educating people about the Philippine X kitchen and why she prefers the non-gendered form of the word. Amelia is warm, she's generous, she's wise, and it's no surprise that her authentic chicken adobo recipe has been viewed over a million times on YouTube. Her willingness to listen to her deep intuition is an example of the goodness that can await all of us, even when we take the long and winding road to follow our dreams.
Well, hello, Amelia. Welcome to the Lifted Podcast.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I am thrilled to have you. I've been looking forward to this conversation. We have so many things, so much ground to cover, I talked to you for hours and hours and hours. I always like to sort of anchor the conversation or begin the conversation since we're talking about food. I love to talk about origin stories and get a sense of people's origin stories around food. So what did your parents do for a living? And what and there's a reason why I ask about the living thing, because if people worked in home or out of the home, that often directs or informs their early childhood experiences with food. So was food a big part of your childhood?
It was and it wasn't. My parents were separated or divorced. And my mom is a first generation. She moved here from the Philippines when she married my dad. So she was very much on the path of trying to go to school, trying to create a life, trying to be a single mom to a young child while also navigating a new country. So I would say that like for her in my relationship in my home life with her, food wasn't always like the focus of our life. Like it was just kind of like this thing that had to get put on the table, you know, to like, to check the boxes of life, you know, as sometimes as moms we have to do. And so, but her sister, her cousins, her family would come over. And that's when a lot of my food experiences were really like in my life in a strong way, because our strong connection to Filipino food and the Filipino gathering. On my dad's side, he was also kind of navigating single dad life, but also was in the military. So he had a very strong connection to food in a way that really impacted how I cook in the kitchen, how I perceive food, how I build flavors. And he was very much the most basic cook. We're talking like onion powder, garlic powder. He's like, this is the building blocks of all your food is onion powder and garlic powder. And for my whole life, I was like, oh yeah, that's it. All I needed. But now I'm like, oh, actually onions and real garlic also are excellent. So, you know, so he actually taught me how to look at food from like almost like an artistic point of view. He was always proud of his little like creations in the kitchen. And so I always take that with me and treasure those thoughts.
I love that you shared that it's a father's influence that directed that. I mean, I have a similar experience insofar as working mom, not so interested in cooking all the time.
Yeah.
My dad, who had custody of us periodically or every other weekend, he used that time with us, those weekends, really intentionally and really in the kitchen. And he was early on not a great cook. But again, what was it with the onion powder and the garlic powder? He just thought that similar. I mean, I completely relate. Anyway, so I know that for you grew up very early, I think the first 5 years of your life in the Philippines, and then you were in Southern California. Am I correct? Yeah. So you sort of, your formative years are between the Philippines and where specifically, would you tell us?
I was born in San Diego, but then my dad, because he was in the military, we lived also in Hawaii. And then we moved to the Philippines when I was, I think, 3. And then I lived there till my parents separated. And I was like almost 6, I think.
Okay. You are very intentional and specific in your writing and in your discussion of the cuisine of the Philippines. And you don't refer to it as Filipino cooking. Introduce us to how you describe food from the Philippines and why.
I've referred to it as a lot of things. Once being raised in Southern California, also like I feel like having a feminist mind, like the old like language paradigms of male and female like never really jived with me in the right way. Personally, like I would say my pronouns are she, her, they, them, because I don't want to like subscribe to this female, male, like paradigm. And this is actually a very controversial concept for Filipinos from the Philippines and even diaspora Filipinos, because it can ruffle a lot of feathers. So I don't mean to do that when I talk about it. This is just my personal experience and my own personal feelings on the language stuff. But I felt like diaspora cuisine, Philippines for me cuisine, just embodies kind of the whole of everybody versus just certain types of people within, you know, my cultural background. So I, when I talk about food and when you say I'm intentional about food, it's like, I really want to be very inclusive to everybody when I write about food, and also like come from a perspective of like not feeling like I'm above, or, you know, like just because I have so much education, like my ego is like driving the concepts of what I write. I really want to like write about things that inspire me and that like also are aligned with my highest and greatest good, whatever that means.
I love that you share that. And that is it is important to sort of, especially as a creator and as a creative person, to sort of really embody and share with the world your point of view. And it's even in reading your writing about this and about this decision, it really gave me a window into the complexity, first of all, of the culture of the Philippines, right? Domination, colonization, yes. And then the diaspora. And so what I see and what I've learned from your writings is that there is a deep well of many layers of history and culture, and that can't be defined in like one word. That's really Absolutely. What I hear. Wow. It's bigger than one word. Bigger than a word. And so yeah. I don't know. It just was very, I really appreciated you saying that. And I wanted to sort of bring that forward into the conversation, because also you're, you know, a part of the colonialist past of the Philippines is to sort of impose, and that's the Spanish who colonized, you know, ascribed that to nouns, you know, and whatnot. So anyway, thank you for your work in that space and using it as an opportunity to educate while also inviting us into this delicious cuisine that we're going to talk about.
Yes. Thank you. Honestly, thank you so much for closing that loop on what was actually in my thought is like that language does come from the Spanish and their colonization of us. And they forced their words and their language concepts, and also like how we even name our own last names. Like we had to choose from a list of names what we could be called. And that's why there's so many Spanish names within the Filipino diaspora, is because we were kind of like given a list and said, well, you can choose your name from this list. So those kind of like language paradigms, for me, like they felt very oppressive. And I don't think that like a lot of people look at it that way from the diaspora, but that's okay. Like however we choose to identify with our culture, is there's no wrong way. You know, it's just all how, what we take away from ourselves. So
I am really deeply trying to take that one. I am shocked. Thank you for sharing that piece of history. I was completely ignorant to the list of names. I mean, talk about reducing. That feels so incredibly, there's erasure there. It's reductive there. Wow. Okay. So I can see why, in light of that, if I were given a list that is like, hi, we're going to reduce everything down to this list, choose and go forward. That it's a brave act of reclaiming to challenge that through your work around food. And I think that's incredible.
I will like to add that my family chose the name Soberano, which means sovereign. And I kind of, like, obviously I wasn't there when they chose the name, but I wonder if my ancestors were also rebellious because they chose a name that meant I'm sovereign from this oppression of this name you're giving me, and they've chosen this one name. So I wonder about that, just in my own family line, my own ancestry, like how we got to the name Soberano. But I'm really proud of that name choice, because I'm like, you guys chose wisely. Thanks for that.
This is incredible, and it's perfect segue to sort of, I know we were talking about the early food memories in the home, but I'm also curious about early food memories outside of the home. What I mean by that is, in many conversations this season of the show, I've been talking with women of diverse backgrounds about their early memories around food. And I have heard, and I have my own experiences of, like, the food that's cooked in the home that then is taken out of the home, and like how you have one relationship with it at home, but out in the larger American world, that food is perceived in often a non-favorable light. And I'm going to read a quote that you said. You said, growing up Asian and specifically Filipino X, am I saying that correctly?
Filipino X, whatever.
Filipino X, okay. In the US, it means to have to put up with a lot of ignorant commentary around food. What? Okay, so what I'm picturing is you take some food from home, leftovers in the lunchbox.
Yeah.
To school, what happens in Southern California?
I grew up in a small San Diego suburb. Being Filipino, there wasn't a lot of Filipinos until I was older, and then we started to identify each other. But I feel like the longstanding trope around Filipino cuisine is about eating dog, about it smelling funny. Oh, Filipino, oh, that, you know, those type of comments. And they're all like, they're just all like, what are you talking about? Like, when you're growing up, there is a layer of shame that you get for yourself in this space too, where you're like, okay, like, do what? Like, you start asking your family questions, you start questioning yourself, and you're like, well, this adobo tastes really great, and there's not dog in it to my estimation. And so there are those kind of comments, and like comments about how food smells. There's a lot of fish sauce. There's a lot of like essence of the sea, I guess, to put it nicely. But also, like, if you travel to the Philippines, you'll see that there are stalls and stalls of dried fish. Like, it is like a core base flavor for my people. So, you know, it's just kind of like when you grow up and you start to grow out of that kind of like mental space and celebrate your own culture and see the ignorance for what it is, which, you know, you do hopefully do eventually. But you learn that those and that it's their own ignorance and their own, you know, maybe lack of palate growth and palate, you know, adventure that is keeping them in that space. And that it's not like, yes, it's ignorance, but, you know, it's also like you can choose to try other things and form new opinions. And if you want to form opinions without trying it, then I don't actually listen to your opinion anymore. So
what were your aspirations career-wise as a child?
Oh, honestly, I have no idea. I thought when I graduated high school, I was going to move to New York and be on Broadway. And so it's really funny. I never even went to New York till 2006, fun fact. And then I got kind of caught up in this other life that I got caught up in the life that I think my family wanted for me and not the one that I wanted for myself, which comes up with as an immigrant child, there's like always a lot of expectations. I also don't feel like I had the familial root foundation that I could have had, you know, like, so I wasn't like in my early young adult life, like feeling very focused, knowing what I wanted. And it didn't come to me until I had to do my own personal growth work within myself. So it wasn't until I was like 35 when I threw out to my husband, like, hey, let's move to New York and let me try to go to culinary school and see what happens. Like, I had no idea that I would be on the path that I am now. It was just totally like, hey, what if we did this? And we fully like moved on a hope and a prayer and two fingers crossed and like all of like throw it. Yeah. And just moved into this space and tried something new. And the last 10 years of being in New York have been incredibly transformational on so many levels. Like, one, I created a career for myself that I do love, that I'm excited about. I do now 10 years later, see it shifting in a way, but I'm so thankful for the time that I've had here.
It's a perfect answer because I think so many people feel like, oh, I had to sort of know what I wanted to do from the beginning, right? And this idea of like early or midway through your adult life, you know, you're talking to someone who, you know, I was into my 40s when I first got the idea to maybe I could write a book. So I understand what it means to sort of make this pivot at a time when you're like, life has been one way, but I'm called to do something new. That's really valuable. And so I thank you that you shared that. I think a lot of listeners will take great comfort in knowing you don't have to know it right now.
You don't have to know when you're 30. You don't have to know when you're 35, but when you feel the call, do not ignore it. So
exactly. So you're in Southern California, I'm assuming, and you're talked to your husband and you are called to
I'm in Seattle at this time. So I lived in Seattle for 12 years. My dad is from the Northwest. So when I was 25, I was a single mom and I wasn't happy in Southern California. And I didn't want to raise my daughter by myself. I just didn't feel like I also had the, like, I was like, I don't really have this solid foundation of family to keep me here, to help me raise my child. I'm already doing this on my own. So what if I just move somewhere else? And that felt more in line with who I was becoming. And so Seattle was very much that place. I think I just kept moving to a bigger, bigger city every time. So I moved to Seattle and I lived there for 12 years. My husband, I actually moved from Miami to Seattle and he had never loved Seattle the way I loved it. And so it was an easy like, hey, what if we move? And it was while I was in Seattle, I was starting to get like a larger education about food, cooking. I worked for, it's the oldest co-op in the nation called Puget Consumer Co-op, PCC in Seattle. So they have like a bunch of, it's a store chain, but they're a certified organic retailer. And I was given the education of ingredients. Like, I worked in the grocery store and I'm like, wow, I've never seen some of these ingredients before. And I've never heard of some of these foods before. I someday I'm going to write the story about how like the co-op is like the place where so many like everyday Americans learn about cultural cuisine, because I feel like co-ops really try to showcase like diverse cuisine. And in that place, they had a cooking school. So I used to work for the cooking school and I used to go and like clean the kitchen at the cooking school and like get them all ready for the chef to come in. And I would help like assist classes. I used to teach like kids cooking classes through them. And then I started a garden and then it was over. Once I started a garden, it was over. I was like, oh, I have all of these things I'm growing and I don't even have the knowledge on how to utilize all of these ingredients. So then that's when I started thinking about school.
So the gardening is what led you to culinary school.
Yes. It was kind of like a seeing that I had a lack of knowledge. Like, I had this abundance of produce, but I didn't know all of the ways I could be utilizing it. So it was kind of like a culmination of all of this, like these little bits of information and seeing that I was really inspired by cooking.
When you entered culinary school, did you have any sense of the term I'm going to use, because we talk about it a lot in the world. And I think as women, it gets talked about a lot, imposter syndrome. Did you feel like, oh my goodness, everyone else is supposed to be here. They understood that they wanted to be a chef from the beginning, or, you know, they're well suited for this, did you have any of those thoughts? And if so, how did you overcome them?
I still have these thoughts. I still have these thoughts. I'm in therapy every week. That is very helpful. And also just realizing that I do have my own gifts and skills that are unique to me, there's a reason, not like there's a reason, but there, I'm here. I have a purpose, you know, and I just want to use my gifts and my tools to open my own pathway.
Yeah, I was picturing, you know, first day of culinary school.
Yeah.
Were there any female chefs?
There was a female chef that taught. There was multiple female chefs. There was many females in my class. I was probably one of the oldest people in my class. I remember that. I remember everybody was like 22 or 25. And I was here like maybe 30, I think I was 36 or 37 at the time. So I definitely was like, I'm old enough to be your auntie, you know what I mean? Like, but of course I feel, and the funny thing is like New York is such a different beast than the West Coast. Like the competitive bite is like, it is a real thing. And everybody always pegs me for being a West Coaster. They're like, oh, you're from the West Coast, aren't you? I'm like, yes, I am. Because I think there's like an approachability to me that but I also feel like it's really easy to get put into that trap of imposter syndrome because people are constantly trying to make you feel like you're not enough. But that feeling of being enough has to come from within inside of you. So it's kind of like the self-work and the self-healing work has really helped me kind of step out of that space of like, wanting to compare myself to other people's journeys. I have a completely different background than most people that I know. And so my path hasn't been quite straightforward and maybe with the ease that some other people's have. And that's okay. But I've still made it here in spite of everything. And that's what I always try to remember when I'm feeling a little bit like I don't belong or maybe people don't get me or it's kind of like I'm enough. I know I made it this far against all odds. And for me, it's a celebration.
You mentioned just now that inner work, right? That inner work, and you've referenced being in therapy. If you could, off the top of your head, just share what some of that inner work looks like, because I think people are leaning in right now. Everybody is like, because it's such a familiar thing, right?
Yes.
We all know, and we sort of intellectually understand that we need to go in and sort of adjust our inner lens, right, on the world. But the how we do that, one, I know it's unique to each person, but I do think there's some good principles that can be shared and then adapted to each person. So what are some of, if you could just share some of the things for yourself that make you feel like, you know what? I have a point of view. I have a voice. It matters. And I'm going to keep going.
Well, like you said, everybody's journey is different. And for me, it started with a level of self-awareness. Like, hey, I keep running into this issue in my life. Like, where's my responsibility here? I also had a lot of guides, like see the potential in me. And if it wasn't for these guides seeing the potential in me and leading me down a path of like, hey, I see something in you. You could be really great. Here's how you can educate yourself. So for me, I would say the beginning of my journey started in how I communicate and learning how to communicate with love, learning how to communicate out of my ego, because my ego was really driving things. And when I saw how much my ego was driving, because I wasn't living presently and I wasn't living consciously. And once I got into focus, my impact on the world, and that was a huge moment for me. Like, oh, wow, I can impact in all these positive ways, but here's all the negative ways. Not only am I impacting my community, but first impacting myself. And so I had to start changing the integrity with myself. So one of my keywords for my life, and I think if I had like, you know, those like banners of European aristocracy, and they're like, here's our five like things that our family is about, like, you know, mine would be integrity. So my first and learning all of the ways I was out of integrity with myself, and I'm still learning all the ways. And once I started to change the integrity within myself and the ways I was falling up short on myself and not living into the fullest possibilities within myself, then you start impacting your greater group, right? So it's just kind of like, that was the first step. And so having integrity with myself also meant integrity with how I speak to people, how I speak about people. I was raised in an environment where maybe the women in my life didn't speak kindly about other women in our lives. And you'd kind of learn these traits and habits, and then you start to dismantle them when you start to see they're not working so well for you. So that was the first key for me. It was like, let me get right with me. Let me get right with my integrity with me. And then I'm going to get right with my children. And then I'm going to get right with my family. And it's just going to continue to grow.
I love this share because it's helping clarify for me how you specifically, but I think anyone is able to do the big, more intentional work in the world that doesn't happen casually. It doesn't just fall out of the sky. There's a great deal of inner foundational work that's being done that is often invisible to the casual passerby. But what we do experience and see, and what is very clear in your writing and in your work in the world, in your Substack, and in the videos you put out, is there is a kind of a heartbeat of love, right? And there's a sense that you're bringing forward something that we haven't quite seen before. And you're holding space for educating, sharing, but doing it from a heartfelt place. I mean, that's just sort of, you know, anyone who's going to, and I hope so many people are going to visit and learn about your work after this conversation, it's very, very evident. So it makes sense that that's a part of the pillars of what you're doing. And why you have to do that in a cutthroat female environment, because I'm sure if, you know, listen, I started my career in Hollywood. Yeah. I understand the kind of outward egoic, big personality, cutthroat, zero-sum game approach to life. And that didn't work for me, but I loved what I do. And so you find a way, and you find a way to do what you love, but with integrity. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Was there a moment when you're like, I hear the call, I'm going to answer it. And by the way, I'm not just going to answer it and become a food writer. Like, I also do X, Y, and Z. What was that moment? Or was it a series of many moments?
I think they're separated into two moments. The first moment would be in 2011, my brother passed away. He was killed in a car accident. He was 22 years old. He was so young. And wow, when you lose someone, as you know, your concept of time changes, I think. Time for yourself changes. And it was kind of like he could be robbed of his life at 22. I could get robbed of my life at any time. So it was in 2013 when I decided to move. I think that's not an accident. So 2011, he passed away. It was about 2 years later, exactly, when I was like, I'm hearing the call. I think I had to sift through a certain amount of grief and move through some of that, like deeper, like those first few years are just absolutely terrible until you learn how to figure it out for yourself, like how grief lives within inside of you and exists in your everyday. And for me, it was kind of like, life is too short to waste time on drama, crap, my trauma, my past. All I want is a future. All I want is to create the future that my poor brother did not get to create for himself. And I have this chance. I have a chance to create this life for myself. And so with losing my brother, and I've written about the bittersweet gifts of death. You know, it's the worst. It is the absolute worst. But there are gifts within the darkness. And if you choose to pay attention to those gifts and focus on bringing light into that space and not existing always in this dark space, I feel like he's just propelling me forward this whole time. Like, he's opening doors for me. He's like, hey, actually, I've got you. And so, there's that part that's really propelled me into the space of where I am in New York, in like going to school, like uprooting my entire family, doing this whole thing. He was definitely the moment that created a lot of change. However, branching out into all the different ways that I have branched out in is, I think, more of a survival technique than anything. Like,
I want to say, first of all, I am sorry for the loss of your brother. I learned of that when we first connected, and you wrote a beautiful piece about that was connected to my story.
Yeah.
And I read your piece, which we'll link to in the notes. And it moved me so deeply. And that my story of grief connected to your story of grief. And I remember reading it and thinking, Sato knows her brother somewhere on the other realm. We talked and somehow this has just happened, because it was this beautiful, beautiful connective tissue around food. And again, oddly around diaspora, because I'm like, the lentils, which were not a part of your probably home cuisine, they weren't a part of my home cuisine growing up, but somehow grief had like brought lentils to both of our tables, right? It was like interesting and beautiful way. And so for people who have lost someone and who are processing that and asking what comes next, you and I are here to say, there is a comes next. It is. There is a comes next. Yeah. There is. And that can be wildly beautiful. And it can begin with a what if. Mm-hmm. What if I lived, I'm not going to say lived for them, but I lived in honor of all the living they didn't get to do.
Absolutely. I think about that all the time. How am I living in the spirit of his generosity? How am I living in the spirit of his creativity? He was an artist. And how can I live the world where I get to fully realize my potential the way he should have been able to? So absolutely. And there is a life, and you may not want to live it. It's, but hopefully you'll see that you do want to live it. And you're only hopefully living within their spirit if you're living it out fully, because that's what they would have wanted, yeah. You know.
You have a Substack called
Did You Eat Yet?
Did You Eat Yet? Okay. And you had a recent post this year in 2023 called Food Media is Dying and the SEO, the search engine, is killing it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to just read one quote and have you tell us about this. You say food writing has turned into commodity writing. It's now a volume business where quantity over quality is favored. And you go on to say that these companies, that how that they are prioritizing equitable stories, how are they doing that when the white gaze is dictating what food stories get told? What do you mean by that?
This is my hill I'm going to die on.
That's okay. We're here for it all.
I mean, I've just been existing in this space since, you know, deep in it since 2014. So I've been able to watch how it's evolved. I've seen it become from one thing. I've seen it evolve to something else. And then I've seen it evolve again. So basically what I mean by that is, I've often used the term gaming the system for clicks. And I feel like food media, including all your favorite legacy publications, are doing that. The digital space, the digital food media space, is not a space where organic storytelling gets told anymore.
What I hear you saying is you've referred to it as that where we once had journalism and storytelling in around food stories and food cultures, what we're now getting is service journalism. We're simply servicing the search engine optimization. Yeah. And it becomes so self-referential and so insular that we're only really covering five things. Once again, it's like being given a list, as you used early on in your talking about, you know, with Spain and the Philippines. You're given a list and it's like, here, you can only choose from this list of things to talk about. And that's what's happening with food media, which is absolutely different than food journalism. Food media is driven by keywords and keywords only. And then it becomes, oh, what are the majority of 12-year-olds in America clicking on? Then I guess that's what we're all supposed to be writing about.
Thank you for bringing that into full circle and for making that more clear.
Amelia, I want to thank you so much for joining me here. I have been so lifted by this conversation. It's gone in so many different and beautiful places. And I feel inspired by your work. And I thank you for your work in the world.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel like you're such a bright light, and I always knew that we were going to have this conversation someday, and you're everything that I had hoped you were going to be, which is, you're just such a positive beacon, and I see that in your work. And so thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Lifted is developed, written, and produced by me and my one-woman producing team, Celia Cates. It is edited by Jamie Moss. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for our next inspiring episode.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com. Save big money.